But if you refuse categorically, as a matter of policy, to ever pardon that lease, which the unadmitted they did in this case, and also you say, we're not going to drill, period, there are no prospects, it's not worth drilling. If you do those two things together, at some point, you are not acting in a reasonable and approved operator. The fourth thing that Jackson proved at trial was that Sun lacked a geological data system. They lacked systematic review of maps. They lacked mapping update procedures. All of this is explained at length in the brief. But finally, the Jacksons proved that Sun did not act as the original and proven operator in drilling activities. And that goes to the next three things that you find in Judge Layman's opinion in Fellmont. And the next three things are virtually adopted verbatim in Clifton versus Coombs' opinion. These three things are again at 455 of Fellmont. The first one says that producing strata on horizon, which they contend should have been further explored, there's that word, or drilled, required additional wells. Two, that strata or horizons other than those on which production is being obtained, on which further exploration or drilling is sought, there's the word exploration again, exist in reasonable probability, not in certainty, which I don't think anybody can ever prove, but in reasonable probability. And finally, that by the drilling of additional wells, there would be a reasonable expectation of profit, not only to the lessor, but to the lessee.
What was your evidence on that?
Reasonable expectation of profit? It's Defendant's Exhibit 53, which is in the appendix to our brief, and I believe it is at the appendix 4 in the brief, Defendant's Exhibit 53. And then also in the appendix to the brief, there's an excerpt from our expert's testimony, which is Appendix 8. There's about three pages of it, which he further goes into that. So in order to meet this last criterion, that the well should be drilled and there's a reasonable expectation of profit in doing it. Mr. Von Thunglin, who was the Jackson's expert in this case, and the Miller Lynch firm in Houston, who was a former vice president of Shell Oil Company, he certainly wasn't some firebrand throwing radical in this thing, came up with five prospects. And he said that a reasonable and prudent operator would drill each one of them. Contrary to the assertions of counsel in their brief, the odds on some of these prospects were very good. For instance, the Hackberry prospect had a 3 out of 4 chance of success. The Sea Breeze prospect had a 1 out of 4 chance of success. And then the two of the Vicksburg prospects had a 1 out of 12 chance of success. And the third one had a 1 out of 15 chance of success. The point is, you've got to view these situations as a reasonable improvement in the oil business would view them. And that's what Mr. Von Trungen's testimony expressly adopts. You're not looking at a trust officer standard in a bank as to what he would do. You're looking at a person in the oil business, and the testimony was clear on both sides. Everybody, all the experts agreed that there is risk in drilling any oil and gas well. But what Mr. Von Trungen showed was that five wells should be drilled. So we showed that one, the Sun failed to act as a reasonable and prudent operator, but two, that they failed to drill certain specific wells that would generate a reasonable expectation of profit that a reasonable and prudent operator would drill. And he said he could have come up with a lot more, but at some point he felt like he was doing some geological work for them. Now, the Court of Appeals called these five wells exploratory development wells. And that is a term adopted by the Court of Appeals, and it's not a bad explanatory term. I think it's...
How does that differ from a wildcat well?
It's different in this respect, and I'll refer it over to Defendant's Exhibit 38 that is over here. Defendant's Exhibit 38 is published by the American Association of Petroleum Geologists and the American Petroleum Institute. Both of the experts in the case, Jackson's expert and Sun's expert, agreed that this was accurate and this was acceptable. And those references are Statement of Facts, Volume 6, page 60 through 62, Statement of Facts, Volume 4, page 240 through 41. You will notice that in Category 1, up at the top, That's a wildcat. The American Association of Petroleum Geologists says that's when you're drilling for a new field on a structure or in an environment never produced before. The Jackson's expert, Mr. Von Tuglin, said the first well drilled in Oyster Bayou was a wildcat. Okay. Now, categories 2, 3, and 4, if you will look over to the left, and this is in the handout in case any of you can't see this. Those kinds of wells, which are new pool wildcats, deeper pool tests, and shallower pool tests, are drilling for a new pool on a structure or in a geological environment that's already productive. And then you skip on down to a development well, which seeks to exploit or develop hydrocarbon accumulations discovered by a previous driller. The courts, I submit with all respect to the courts, get into a great deal of confusion when they talk about only exploratory wells, or only development wells, or only wildcats, and only development wells. There's all different kinds of oil and gas wells. The difference between them primarily is one of risk. I think you could view all oil and gas wells as existing on a continuum of risk, with over here being low risk, over here being high risk. And where the particular well falls on this continuum is really in the eye of the beholder. I mean, different people view these things in different ways. One person's development well is with another person's rank wildcat, and with another person's outpost extension well. But the point is that you need to view all of these things according to a reasonable and prudent operator standard and see whether a reasonable and prudent operator would drill this well. Remember that the people like the Jacksons in these cases, they don't get paid anything for this production. They are paid a royalty, which is an expense-free percentage of production. Unless they're drilling, they will get nothing. So it is very frustrating to them to see people clamoring to drill wells on their lease, wanting to drill wells. And these people say that there will be a reasonable expectation of profit. Sun says, no, we're not going to drill the well, we're not going to farm out the well, we're not going to do anything, period. What this case does, and this is clear on Clifton versus Kennedy, we're not asking to change the law one iota. It lets a court decide whether or not the lessee is acting as a reasonable and prudent operator. It gives the poor lessor some relief in seeing how the lessee is conducting its operations on their land.
Counsel, before you move on to your statement that you're not asking us to change the law, but to follow it.
Correct.
How would you respond to the statement that's been made that there is no Texas case that has allowed unconditional cancellation of a lease based on a breach of an implied covenant?
Well, let's look at that.
Would this be the first?
This would be the first appellate case. That's correct, Your Honor.
So in that sense, isn't there a change of the law?
No, Your Honor, and for this reason. The estate of W.T. Wagner versus Sigler Oil Company back in 1929 said, the preferred remedy is conditional cancellation. It would have been very simple for Justice Greenwood when he wrote that opinion to say the only remedy, but he did not. They were referring, and you can look at the very tail end of the Wagner estate opinion when you look at this. He was referring to an experience that Kansas has had in law recently where Kansas had adopted the conditional cancellation decree. And he made reference to Professor Merrill's treatise on the implied covenants in oil and gas leases when they made this adoption of Kansas law. In the handout that I've given to the court this morning, I have quoted from the second edition of Merrill's treatise, section 170, and I want the court to see what happened to the very rationale of the estate of Sigler's opinion, and I'll remind the court that the estate of Wagner versus Sigler Oil Company case was decided in 1929 at the very dawn of petroleum era in Texas. But Merrill's treatise says, more recently, however, the court held that the lessee had no ground to complain of a failure to enter an alternative decree rather than a forfeiture when the lessee had assumed the position that development would be unprofitable if the oil commanded a certain price and he did not intend to drill until it had to. So very quickly after the estate of Wagner versus Sigler case was decided, the rationale of the case changed completely in that it had its underpinning recognized in certain instances you can have an absolute forfeiture. It's a matter of historical, not historical note, but it's a matter of some interest that now Kansas has specifically codified that and says you can outright cancel an oil and gas lease. That is in the Texas National Association of Oil and Gas Group. I think that if I wanted to present the argument the best I could, which I do, about why you should unconditionally cancel a lease in Texas, is one, look at the situation that the Jacksons are in this case. They fought this long, hard, arduous battle against Sun. Sun wants a wrist slap and put it right back where it was after the Jacksons approved that gross malfeasance had occurred. I know of no other rule of law, and it would be curious to adopt one in an oil and gas case like this, but as a matter of law, no matter what a lessee does, no matter how bad, no matter how often, you always give him a second chance. I agree with what counsel has said about the fee simple determinable nature of the oil and gas lease. We're not talking about an automatic forfeiture or condition. This lease has been perpetuated by production. It is perpetuated today except for the trial court's decree. What we're saying is that a court of equity should have the latitude in entering either a conditional decree, or if the situation is bad enough, they should be able to enter an outright decree. So let's look at the utility of a conditional decree in this case, and this comes up as germane to the Jacksons' application for writ of error in the remand portion of this. At trial, and these references are fully expanded in our brief, at trial, Sun said, this is a miserable picture. Nobody would drill on this lease. We're not going to drill on this lease. I submit to you, what good would it do to go in with a conditional decree and go back to the poor trial judge and ask him to become a geologist and a geophysicist and impose a court-controlled and court-supervised drilling program, which is like what was done in the Sinclair versus Masterson case. That makes just no sense. Also, this case is different in this respect. If I make this point more than once, it's because it's so important. The Jacksons aren't saying simply, Son, you didn't drill this well and that well. They're saying, Son, you didn't do the bare threshold things that you must do to determine whether to drill a well or not. I think in a case where you've got that kind of fact situation where a conditional decree would be futile, where the lessee is not simply failing to drill wells, but simply failing to do the things that would allow that lessee to determine whether or not to drill wells, where you've got clear testimony from the experts that Sun was holding this lease for speculative purposes, that you've got clear-cut evidence of bad faith and gross misconduct, which is all outlined in the brief and has to do with the drilling of well 66, that when you have those kind of facts, you should at least give the trial court some latitude in doing this, because I submit to you, canceling an oil and gas lease is a very natural thing for a trial judge to do. And if you'll look in the cases, you'll find trial judges doing it frequently. You need to look no further back than the case of Atlantic Richfield versus Gruy out of the San Antonio court, which was NRE by this court last fall. There, the trial court canceled the lease. The case was reversed because, like in Clifton versus Coons, the lessor had not produced any evidence. But when we say that there are no appellate cases saying that you can cancel a lease outright in Texas, that ignores
unconditional.
The trial judge to do it frequently.
Yeah. Let me just ask you a quick question. There was a representation that was made that the royalty owners make $11,000 per day in royalties. Is that correct?
I've never audited it, but it sounds about right.
And you're asking us to do equity, and I find it a little bit hard to get any sympathy for royalty owners making $11,000 per day. And you're asking us to do equity. And just something unseemly about that.
Your Honor, the point of that is, one, if the royalty owners are making that much a day, multiply times seven, and you get what Sun is making a day. But the oyster value field was discovered in 1940 or 1941. Sun has done a good job of that. Both the experts in this case testified that you had to view Sun's job with the rest of the lease and Sun's job in the oyster value field separately. And there have to be rules that would help the Jacksons in an instance like this. For instance, Sun has essentially told the Jacksons, you have no right to make more money or do better. We're taking care of them. I'm simply saying that we should have a neutral standard by which to judge a lessee's conduct, in that another lessee would have made the Jacksons more money. In that regard, please recall...
What kind of conditional cancellation would you find acceptable?
Well, the conditional cancellation that I would find acceptable is what the trial court imposed in this case. And this is an expression I use, and I'm almost hesitant to use it because it's so descriptive. I call that conditional cancellation the eat what you kill descriptive cancellation. In other words, the trial court judge, you've got to look at him sitting there. Son has said, we're not going to drill, period. It's no good. So the court is thinking, what can I order them to do? Now, a lot of these wells are expensive, and I'm sure Judge Wilburn is hesitant to go ordering a bunch of things. But Judge Wilburn, and I think a great deal of wisdom, said, okay, son, you've got a period of time, and you can drill all you want, and if you find production, you get to keep the acres attributable to it. In that instance, it would be a fair conditional decree. Now, Mr. Chief Justice, let me emphasize this. A judge's latitude in this case has to be considerable. Let's say you had a case before the court again, like Aiken versus Coons, where you had a 350-acre tract, and the dispute boiled down to should one well have been drilled or not. In that kind of situation, a conditional decree makes eminent sense, and I have no problem with the conditional decree continuing to be the preferred remedy. I'm not in favor of a rule of law which allows oil and gas leases to be canceled in a willy-nilly manner. But I submit to the court that in some instances where the lessee's conduct is this flagrant, the trial court judge has to have some latitude in deciding.
How much was unconditionally canceled?
In Sun versus Jackson?
No, in this case.
In the Clifton? In this case, the blue acreage was unconditionally canceled. The blue up to the left and blue down to the right.
What kind of a conditional cancellation would have satisfied you?
I don't know that there's any kind of conditional cancellation other than possibly the kind that the trial court did in this case, which was, as I refer to it, the eat what you kill type cancellation.
I'm talking about on that part in which he decreed an unconditional cancellation. Suppose he had considered a conditional cancellation there. What conditions do you think would have been fair and equitable to impose?
In light of Sun's testimony in trial that there was nothing worth doing, that there were no wells that should be drilled, they were not going to farm it out, and they were not going to do anything, I don't think there is anything that could have done justice in that situation. I don't know what it would have been, because remember what we're saying fundamentally here is, Son, you didn't explore the lease in the first place. Not that you didn't simply drill the wells. I can't imagine what kind of a conditional decree we could have used, except that possibly what the trial court did use on the conditional portion of it.
I understand you had other people who wanted to drill this and who would have leased it had you been able to get this.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think the evidence is replete with that. And that's what started the dispute, quite frankly.
Right.
On behalf of the Jacksons, I ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals' opinion in all respects except to the remand portion. And in that respect, we ask that the court affirm the trial court's judgment.
Pick up on what I think I heard as the last remark of Mr. Watt. It's my understanding of this record that there is no record evidence that anybody proposed to drill a well on this lease. I don't think there's anything in the record to that effect. I just understood Mr. Watt as saying the record is replete for that. I've got to start with the proposition again that what Sun bought and by the way, paid a substantial bonus consideration for, to start with, was a lease that granted a fee simple determinable title, just as respectable a real estate title as a deed to a house lot is. And that lease had express terms in it, and that's what Sun paid a fair consideration for. What you finally get down to in the development of this kind of argument is that the Jacksons are asking this court to amend that lease after all these years. Now, they're not offering to refund any of the consideration paid for the terms that are expressed in that lease, but they're asking you now to amend that lease, though in effect, to require continuous drilling by the lessee, and so that any time he stops a continuous drilling program, the lease automatically dies as to all that has not been drilled. And all of that on the strength of what they say are five prospective locations that were testified about by their expert in this case. Thousands and thousands of acres to be canceled as a response to something like five prospective locations.
Counsel, I don't really understand why Sun wanted to keep the lease if it thought that it was going to be unproductive.
No, that's not Sun's thoughts, Your Honor. Let me comment on that. There have been some misstatements in the briefing back and forth in connection with that matter. Sun, in the rhetoric of the brief writing, Sun is accused of having said it's not further interested in the property. And that isn't the case at all. This is a very valuable property. Sun wants to keep it. Sun hopes that developments in the technology will come to pass, and perhaps in the very near future, which will make it plausible and prudent business-wise to build further exploratory wells on this property. Sun doesn't want to abandon this property. Sun wants to hold it for future development and intends that at the moment it becomes prudent, and I mean prudent in the sense of a genuine expectation of profit. I'd like to get back to that in a moment. When it becomes prudent in that sense, which is the sense in which the courts have always discussed the implied covenant to develop, Sun wants to work with this property further. And Sun has demonstrated that intention, as I said earlier, at least 16 times on this lease by drilling that many pure exploratory wells.
So then Sun does think it will be profitable.
It hopes it's going to be profitable. At the present time, where we differ with our opponents is that they have an expert who developed these prospects on a 1 out of 12 chance basis, and in one case a 1 out of 15 chance basis, and Sun doesn't think that's prudent, and Sun doesn't want to drill those particular prospects at the time of the trial. And we're dealing with time of the trial evidence, of course.
Mr. Hoffman, also, we're dealing with a jury verdict here. You tried your case, right or wrong, the jury found that there was a breach of the duty to explore. Now, let's say we reject your argument that that was subsumed under Special Issue Number 1, so that you're stuck with that finding. And then let's say that we agree with you that we should change the law in this state and have unconditional cancellation because of that. This case isn't that stinky, it's not that bad, but that there should be some sort of remedy to nudge you, to make you move forward a little bit more, be a little more aggressive about your program. What would that decree, what should that decree fairly provide?
Your Honor, I think the most you could do, assuming all of those things, the most you could do in a conditional decree on the basis of the record evidence, and it should be based on the record evidence, would be to impose as a condition the drilling of one or more of those prospects that were testified about by the Jacksons expert. Not any more than that. Not drill continuously all over the lease, because he, as I said, he only presented at the most five prospects. We think there's no time for the detail of this, but we think there were only three prospects, actually. And that's all there is in the record to justify any kind of a conditional decree. Not this drilling all over the place and this whole proration unit that you drill and if you get production, you get to keep it. What I'm talking about is a kind of conditional decree that all of the court decisions consider proper conditional decree. There's nothing else in the record that would support a conditional decree. The part of the lease that was unconditionally canceled, for example, all of that south part, south of the road, which is the blue part on that map, their expert only had one prospect in all of that acreage. Now, it wouldn't be fair to require Sun to drill multiple wells on the south part on the basis of what we know right now, when even their expert, their hired expert, only had one prospect that he said was drillable on that acreage. And I would say at the most a conditional decree as to that acreage would require the drilling of that one prospect. And these are all obviously subjective matters that we're dealing with here. They're matters of judgment about which experts can obviously differ. And it would be incredible in our judgment for a lease like this, an oil and gas lease for which fair consideration was paid and in which enormous amounts of money have been invested, to be summarily canceled on the basis of a showing of, quote, reasonable expectation of profit, which was in terms of a 1 out of 12 chance or a 1 out of 15 chance. Superficially even, that's not a reasonable expectation of profit, that's a gamble. Now their expert, when he uses that expression, is obviously using his own definition of reasonable expectation of profit. He's thinking in terms of the reward that is available if you happen to strike, just that substantial potential reward constituting a reasonable expectation of profit. That's the kind of expectation of profit that causes people to go to Las Vegas and play the game. But that's not the kind of reasonable expectation of profit that the courts have talked about in connection with a reasonable, prudent operator. In these cases, and it's obvious from the court opinion, the courts are talking about a reasonable certainty of profit. And the courts have used that expression. That word appears in Clifton against Tunis, by the way. A reasonable certainty of profit. As a matter of law, there can't be a reasonable expectation of profit on a wildcat well. And that's what these prospects are dealing with. Wildcat wells. Wells projected to formations that are either not known to exist under this lease or not known to contain hydrocarbons under this lease. One pretty good example of what I'm talking about lies in the fact that the Jacksons say that they're entitled to cancellation because damages are unascertainable. The cases have said that the primary remedy is damages. They say they're unascertainable. But it's interesting to note that they sought cancellation of this lease on the basis that while damages are not ascertainable, they went on to contend in another form of another part of the case that the prospective wells will yield a reasonable profit. And they even went on to calculate in some fashion that reasonable expectation of profit with dollar signs. It seems pretty obvious to me that if you can't prove their damages for failure to drill the well, then Sun couldn't anticipate a profit if it did drill the well. Actually, I say they were right the first time. There is no feature of the economics of wildcat wells. The economics are certainly not ascertainable, and they're not ascertainable even in the light of an effort to determine an expectation of profit. The economics are not ascertainable either way, and their presentation is clearly in conflict in that connection. And I think that points up our problem here. They are wildcat wells. They are not required by Clifton against Coons. Nothing has changed in that regard. They should not be required now. Thank you. I'm
all counsel for our I'm sorry, we have others to
give a little more time.
Yes,
I beg your pardon, I was not aware. Thank you, Judge Campbell.
I have some additional time.
probably will not take it off.
Quite all right. I just was not aware that you were making any questions.
There are a few points to make. First, with respect to the citation from the text, I think it's perfectly apparent from the case that it is a discussion of Kansas law, not a discussion of Texas law. Secondly, with respect to the question that Chief Justice asked about assuming you disagree with our contention that the special issue regarding expiration was not subsumed in the larger issue, what is the remedy? That has been addressed, Your Honors, in the case of Burnett v. Lacy. And we would suggest that remand would be required, and that under the rule, lessors would be required to show first that there has been a breach of an implied covenant. And over all of this, we urge you to remember that we're dealing with enforcement of an implied covenant. The second element, as in the Burnett v. Lacy case, is whether damages are ascertainable. They say they're not. But certainly if there's a breach and the damages are ascertainable, that is a clear remedy. Then finally in this case, they say, what would a reasonable, prudent operator have done? Specifically, the court says, what constitutes reasonable development? Now, when you have a finding of what constitutes reasonable development and no ascertainable damages, then you have the basis for a conditional decree and cancellation. With respect to Wagner State case, we simply disagree flatly, clearly, with the interpretation placed on that case by counsel and respondents. When it's read, it is very clear that the court is saying no termination or breach of covenant because, among other things, not agreed to. But secondly, even apart from that, title to land should not depend upon the very opinions of experts. And in applying that rule, the court cites an old case by Judge Staten, which goes back to 1891. And that concept has been an integral part of the jurisprudence of this state at least since 1891. It is conceded here and argued to Your Honor that there is a substantial conflict between experts. Now, do we want to change the law so as to divest title, determinable fee, on the basis of which expert is believed? The courts have heretofore said no. We submit that that is the proper approach to continue to take. Thank
you. Let me suggest that if any of you have contemplated post-submission brief, I wish it would hit the area of a conditional cancellation determinant. I don't think anybody wants this court to write an opinion that said the conditional cancellation would be vested or should be determined by what the other side's expert says.
Yes, Your Honor, we certainly address that, and I may just add one comment. There's been a lot of talk, a lot of argument, and a lot of written in the briefs about what the experts say about what one side did and what another side did. But when you get right down to it, the jury found that Sun had acted as a reasonably prudent operator in developing the case, and we submit that control.
Thank you.
And now let me say that we've listened to some very able arguments on both sides, and we appreciate the counsel's efforts. We're going to take a short break.
Please rise.